You mentioned, in fact, two verses, but you said there are three verses.
There are three verses. There's another verse, actually 219. Yeah.
Yes.
That's also.
Would you please?
That's also another verse which explicitly. I just want the audience actually, to for themselves, for their own, yeah, and to refer to that verse and see for themselves that verse also says that khamr and maisir, wine, alcohol, and actually maisir, games of chance, are explicitly forbidden. Okay, and these are the three main verses, but there are of course numerous traditions from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and also from the Imams, infallible Imams, expressly forbidding playing any games of chance and also gambling, especially chess and especially backgammon, which are some of the oldest games that human beings have played, and they continue to play as of today. So chess is forbidden, of course, according to religious according to most religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sistani. He does not, under any circumstances, allow playing chess, and also he does not allow playing backgammon.
I see.
Even if, let's say, in some communities, in some societies, these games are actually considered to be just
purely games.
They are just
like
games
for fun, for example.
Yeah, they are played for fun, and there are also some other reasons, arguments associated with these games. There are people who say, "Okay, we are playing these games to sharpen our minds."
Uh-huh.
Okay, to sharpen our minds, and these are the excuses brought up by some people in order to keep playing these games. But no matter what excuses you bring up, you should not, if you are a follower of Ayatollah Sistani, you should not play it. Even if no betting is involved, even if no money is involved, even if it's no longer considered a means for gambling, in your society, in your community, you should not play it under any circumstance.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. U.S. President Donald Trump has fired his Defense Secretary Mark Esper in the latest sign that the transition to a new Biden administration in January is going to be turbulent on both domestic and foreign fronts. Mark Esper was fired by tweet on Monday afternoon, with the president declaring he was pleased to announce that Christopher C. Miller, the highly respected director of National Counterterrorism Center, unanimously confirmed by the Senate, will be acting Secretary of Defense effective immediately. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borger. The piece is titled, Mark Esper Fired as Pentagon Chief After Contradicting Trump. Stay with us for more of Julian Borger's article. U.S. President Donald Trump has fired his Defense Secretary Mark Esper in the latest sign that the transition to a new Biden administration in January is going to be turbulent on both domestic and foreign fronts. Mark Esper was fired by tweet on Monday afternoon, with the president declaring he was pleased to announce that Christopher C. Miller, the highly respected director of National Counterterrorism Center, unanimously confirmed by the Senate, will be acting Secretary of Defense effective immediately. Chris will do a great job. Mark Esper has been terminated. I would like to thank him for his service. Esper had been at odds with Donald Trump on a number of issues, most importantly his insistence at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests in the summer that there were no legal grounds to deploy active service troops on the streets of U.S. cities. He was also working with Congress on legislation to rename U.S. Army bases named after Confederate generals. In a final interview, Mark Esper predicted that he would be followed by a yes man, adding, "And then God help us." In a coolly worded final letter to the president, Mark Esper wrote, "I serve the country in deference to the Constitution, so I accept your decision to replace me." He left the Pentagon quietly on Monday afternoon without the clap-out from staff traditionally accorded to a departing Secretary of Defense. Miller arrived at the Pentagon on Monday amid questions about the legality of his appointment. By law, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, currently David Norquist, would become Acting Secretary of Defense in the event of a sudden departure at the top. Furthermore, the law requires that a Secretary of Defense to have been out of active duty military service for 7 years. Miller, a former Green Beret, only left the military in 2014, 6 years ago. The law can be sidestepped by a vote in Congress, as was done for Esper's predecessor, James Mattis, a retired Marine general. In the face of Trump's widely reported fury of his intransigence, Mark Esper stopped giving press briefings in the Pentagon in July. He is reported to have written his resignation letter before the election, and Donald Trump may have moved abruptly to prevent his defense secretary from taking the initiative. President Trump insisted he fired retired Marine General James Mattis in December of 2018, even though Mattis's critical resignation letter had been widely circulated. The abrupt firing of Secretary Esper is disturbing evidence that President Trump is intent on using his final days in office to sow chaos in our American democracy and around the world, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said. In an interview with Military Times, given the day after the election and published on Monday, Mark Esper said he was proud of the occasions he stood up to Donald Trump, angry rejecting the nickname of Yesper, used by critics who saw him as too subservient to Donald Trump. My frustration is I sit here and say, 18 cabinet members, who's pushed back more than anybody? Name another cabinet secretary that's pushed back, Esper said. Have you seen me on a stage saying, under the exceptional leadership of blah blah blah, we have blah 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 blah? He claims success in protecting the institution, which is really important to me, and preserving my integrity in the process. At the end of the day, it's as I said, you've got to pick your fights, he added. I could have a fight over anything, and I could make it a big fight, and I could live with that. Why? Who's going to come in behind me? It's going to be a real yes man, and then, God help us. This is purely an act of retaliation by a president thinking more about his petty grievances than about the good of the country, said Lawrence Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Lawrence Korb added, it will make the transition to a new administration even more difficult. The message it sends around the world is that Donald Trump is going to continue his disruptive policies for the rest of his time in office. Meanwhile, Mark Esper may not be the last head to fall in the national security leadership. CNN cited an unnamed senior official that Mark Esper feared the directors of FBI and CIA, Christopher Wray and Gina Haspel, would be next to go. Though President Donald Trump has not conceded defeat in the presidential election, Christopher Miller will only have a little more than 2 months in the role before Joe Biden enters the White House. Mark Esper was Donald Trump's second permanent Secretary of Defense after James Mattis, a retired U.S. Marine Corps general who resigned in late 2018. General Mattis was succeeded by Patrick Shanahan, a former Boeing executive who spent months in the role but was not formally confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Donald Trump came close to firing Esper on 3rd of June when the former Raytheon arms executive publicly contradicted the president over the potential use of the 1807 Insurrection Act to deploy active duty military units against protesters in Washington and other U.S. cities. Mark Esper said the circumstances did not justify the use of the act, which can empower a president to send troops into states against the wishes of local authorities. President Trump had threatened to invoke the law 2 days earlier. Following Esper's remarks, the White House noted it was a decision for the president alone. Mark Esper had also given orders for a battalion of the 82nd Airborne Division and military police units to return to base after they had been flown to the Washington area. He reversed the withdrawal order after visiting the White House, but the troops were withdrawn a few days later. According to reports, quoting administration sources at the time, Donald Trump's aides advised him against firing his second defense secretary, and Mark Esper was urged not to offer his resignation by his own advisors. According to the Wall Street Journal, he had already begun to draft a resignation letter. Esper and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, were heavily criticized by former senior defense officials and military leaders for appearing alongside Donald Trump on 1st of June at a photo opportunity outside a church near the White House, after the surrounding area had been cleared by police and other federal security forces using tear gas, mounted police, and baton charges. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, later apologized for his appearance, saying he should not have been there. In a third source of friction, Mark Esper said he was open to discussion about the renaming of military bases named after Confederate Army officers. The White House had ruled out any change to to the names. Mark Esper became Defense Secretary in July of 2019, succeeding Acting Secretary Shanahan. Shanahan had taken over following James Mattis's resignation, who left the administration over Donald Trump's decision to withdraw troops from northern Syria. After a long silence, James Mattis accused President Trump of abuse of executive office and making a mockery of the Constitution in the administration's response to the George Floyd protests.
In a digital world where messages can be sent in an instant, it's been interesting to note just who sent their messages of congratulations to President-elect Joe Biden and who didn't. For many world leaders, the dutiful message was sent in quick time, but for others, many questioned the rationale behind the delay. One country that has made their feelings clear from the start is the Islamic Republic of Iran, who from the offset have stated that the eventual outcome would not change Iranian foreign policy. But one message that did slip through is the Iranian president's thoughts as to the so-called JCPOA and potential of the US returning to the table. With the JCPOA being ratified by the United Nations, the deal has been written into law and is hence why President Rouhani of Iran has warned that the Americans must learn from the mistakes of their past and insist that Washington use the election of Joe Biden as president to follow a legal and legitimate path back to its international commitments. But for one of the United States' closest allies, it seems that the arrival of Joe Biden as president could spell a huge change in policy, with the Israeli regime quickly stating that Biden being able to re-enter the deal with Iran would be no easy feat. However, is this just Israel scaremongering Biden into avoiding building closer ties with Iran, which will ultimately alienate the Netanyahu and Tel Aviv regime? In fact, so worried is the Israeli regime that one Knesset lawmaker has stated that Biden's likely policies with Iran could lead to the Israeli regime entering a physical conflict with Iran over the notion of nuclear issues. However, Iran has always stated that any nuclear program that it pursues is solely intended for civilian purposes. But with West Asia being so full of fallout left behind by the Trump government, how then will Joe Biden approach the area when he comes into office? And will US foreign policy under Biden truly be designed to bridge the gaps haphazardly created by Trump?
I think what we will see regarding the Middle East is he will want to rejoin the JCPOA and become part of that again. However, the Iranian government has rightly said that the US would need to make some compensation for the damage that has done in these last 2 years since Trump pulled out of it. So that will not be a smoother re-entry to the JCPOA as Biden might like to think.
Much like the Israeli regime realizing the election of Joe Biden will be a game changer for them, so too it seems does the UK realize that the United States may see a very different relationship with Britain when Biden comes into office, meaning that ties with Britain and the US may no longer be such a special relationship. Already, Joe Biden has warned Britain that it will be placed at the back of the queue when it comes to the job list that he's set up. Already, Biden has to somehow reunite the people of his own country before worrying about a dividing Europe, meaning that Britain may find itself in trouble come January. With Boris Johnson already struggling to secure a deal with the EU and now facing the prospect of having nothing to grasp onto in the US, could the election of Biden spell bad news for Boris? For one, Biden is already fuming at the so-called internal market bill, which could upset the Good Friday Agreement, a topic close to the heart of the Catholic and Irish descendant president-elect, Joe Biden. But Johnson's already starting to suffer defeats at home, as the House of Lords have already waved away his internal market bill. much to his embarrassment. It seems that the British have also fallen on bad times with the Brexit deal so far failing, and Biden unlikely to prop up the blundering mistakes of Boris Johnson, which could leave the British very much isolated and very much in economic and political pain. But with many nations around the world planning and preparing for a post-Trump era and promises of a new start with Joe Biden, is it simply just too soon to decide just how each nation wishes to interact with the US, reminding us all not to count our chickens before they hatch?
Yes, it is early for leaders of other countries to be approaching Biden, the president-elect, and talking about trade deals and so on. However, I think people are so anxious to deal with someone who will be at least reasonable that they are reaching out now, even though it is early, and Biden will not be inaugurated for another 2.5 months.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared the winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in the White House. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, made the call after Biden increased his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His win in Pennsylvania gave him enough electoral votes needed to enter the White House. His supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. and several other cities across the country to celebrate the victory. However, the election results represent a widening rift in the American society. Even though Joe Biden received over 75 million votes, breaking the record for more popular votes than any other president in the U.S. history, President Donald Trump managed to garner more than 70 million votes.
There's growing political division in the United States to a level that hasn't been seen in a really long time. You have crumbling infrastructure across the country. You have rising unemployment. They're talking about a second and third lockdown in the United States. The economic situation is really dire. And so two wings of the ruling parties in the United States are fighting against each other.
Many observers had anticipated that the outcome of the election would be disappointing for either side if the other secured victory. But the tight race between the two candidates shows how polarized the American public has become. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the results in court.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on. And this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
He has challenged the results in several states, including Arizona, where the president's campaign filed a lawsuit alleging that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner and the election is far from over. This is despite that a stream of heads of state have already congratulated Biden on his election victory. Trump's unsubstantiated claims about the election results and the possibility of fraud are adding fuel to the already smoldering fire burning in the U.S. society. Trump supporters, some carrying weapons, have rallied in several U.S. cities protesting the results and echoing the president's allegations of fraud, saying the election was stolen.
I think what this election has shown above all else is that the U.S. claim of being legitimate and democratic and having free, fair, and quick elections is collapsing. Nobody believes that myth anymore. And the fact that a country like Bolivia, for example, had faster, more efficient elections even after a coup than the United States just goes to show that.
President-elect Joe Biden seems to have recognized the threat. In his victory speech, he pledged to heal what he called a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now, let's give each other a chance.
But how long will it take until he manages to fulfill his promise, if at all?
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump made it no secret that he was on the warpath when it came to China. Not only did he spark a contentious trade war with the Chinese, but he also brazenly stated that the COVID-19 virus was Chinese-made, sparking notions of racism, which, along with his disastrous handling of the virus in the US, likely cost him his place at the White House. It's therefore strange to see a senior US Air Force commander stating that US troops in the region should prepare for conflict in the near future, echoing tones stated by Chinese President Xi Jinping during a recent visit to a military barracks in China. In spite of the ongoing election saga taking place in the US, the Americans claim that the Chinese are taking part in malicious activities around the Pacific Rim, and in particular in the South China Sea, stating that China is misaligned with international law. Yet it can be argued that the polar opposite is true, as the US seek to provoke and agitate the Chinese by sending senior representatives to Taiwan, as well as stoking the flames in the recent tensions in Hong Kong, suggesting that if anyone should be claiming foul play, it's the Chinese over the Americans. It therefore remains to be asked as to whether the Americans are more eager to start a conflict than China. With the US already embroiled in a host of conflicts around the world, could the US then be seeking to start another with its greatest rival China, not only to cement its place as a world power, but also to stem the rise of the Chinese emerging as a threat to the US hegemony?
I can say that for sure this kind of provocative statement, they come from the United States. They don't come from China. From China there is no, basically no statement or will to provoke a war, basically.
When Donald Trump paid a visit to India, many claim that the partnership formed between Modi and Trump was aimed at sending a message to another regional player, namely China, and it seems that the predictions were correct. The US has also expanded its regional and global sphere of influence further, as it seems that both Germany and Australia have joined the Americans and Indians in the region by performing military exercises in the area, clearly adding another US-backed layer of provocation towards China.
There are many countries involved, but from my point of view, I will say just the countries that are, for sure in the alliance with the United States. I will mention Japan, South Korea, definitely Vietnam, India, and Australia.
Yet with the election of President-elect Joe Biden to the White House, we may see the US reverse its rhetoric towards China, as Biden attempts to pick up the pieces left behind from the Trump legacy. However, there's one very worrying factor in the equation, namely that Trump still has until the end of January before handing over power to Biden, meaning that the unstable president may still have a trick or two up his sleeve, including the temptation of testing the very massive military that he leads. But as Trump finds himself on the way out, many of those surrounding him have also distanced themselves from the outgoing president, including a vital piece of the conflict puzzle, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who has prepared his resignation letter for Trump. But for now, it's probably safe to say that all attention has been diverted away from a conflict between the US and China as the Americans enter a transition period, and Biden waits with anticipation to tell Trump, "You're fired."
Israel is undoubtedly an opportunist regime. It once again proved that this week when it escalated demolitions of Palestinian homes as international media were focused on the presidential election in the United States. On Tuesday, the Israeli army carried out the biggest demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank for a decade. It razed to the ground the homes of nearly 80 Palestinians, mostly children, in the Bedouin village of Herbet Homsa in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli army made sure that nothing was left of the Palestinian structures, which included homes, animal shelters, and solar panels. Palestinians say they had no idea what was about to happen to their homes. The Israelis moved in without prior notice and gave them 10 minutes to evacuate before they started bulldozing. These families are now left homeless and have nowhere to go. Vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinians were also taken away. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shatayya denounced the latest Israeli crime in the occupied territories. Shataye urged the international community to intervene against Israel's attempt to displace the citizens of the Bedouin village and tens of similar Palestinian communities from their homes and lands. The Palestinian premier highlighted the fact that Israel chose Tuesday night to carry out the demolition because global attention was focused on the high-profile vote in America. The demolition drew condemnation from the United Nations and the European Union. So far this year, 689 Palestinian structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says the number is more than the figures in any full year since 2016. Meanwhile, the European Union has highlighted the fact that over 50 Palestinian schools are currently under the threat of Israeli demolition. The Israeli army routinely destroys Palestinian structures in the occupied territories. Anything built without hard-to-get permits, rarely issued by Israel, is at risk of demolition by the Israeli army. Demolition of Palestinian structures and expansion of Israeli settlements are unending. Israeli settlements have been mushrooming in the occupied territories over the past decades. Widespread international condemnation has failed to dissuade the regime from such actions. Pro-Palestinian activists believe even the toughest verbal denunciation do very little to stop such violations of international law. They want the United Nations, the European Union, and other organizations to use their economic leverage with Israel to force the regime to halt its illegal action.
Well, the majority of the EU's exports to the illegal Zionist entity actually come through settlements. So while the EU issues a lot of condemnation of Israel over its illegal settlements, it needs to really put its condemnation into practice by withdrawing from a lot of its economic and bilateral agreements.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the Palestinian cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. As many governments refuse to pressure the regime, Palestinians are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day bear fruit.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in their government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd for 6 weeks and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned, and the economic growth for which China is well known has been restored because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the 750 billion euro EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is of course very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year, and several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are in fact at home, not working. But of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ocean of Dua.
أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil fa. So, dear listeners, as you may have been previously with us, we were talking about what to ask from the Almighty Allah when it comes to supplicating and praying to Allah for ourselves. We talked about generalization. We also talked about asking for the greatest bounties we are capable of imagining. And in the previous program, we started talking about reliance on the divine planning and that tadbir of the Almighty Allah. The supplications of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are replete with this concept, which is really subtle one, And the infallible Imams say that those of the servants of the Almighty Allah who have attained true recognition of Him will never depend on a bounty, however enormous it might be. And this is because of that comprehension. And that is why, as a result, they are never assured by a blessing or provision, and they are never despaired of the Almighty Allah's mercy. In other words, they are rather assured of His mercy, and they do not despair of His grace.
Alhamdulillah, khaliq al-khalq, basit al-rizq, faliq al-asbah, dhil jalali wal-ikram, wal-fadli wal-in'am, alladhi ba'uda fala yura, wa qaruba fashahida an-najwa.
This concept is drawn by the Imam alayhi salam directly from the Holy Quran, so that you may not grieve for what escapes you and not exult for what comes in your way. In the chapter 57, in 23rd verse, it states, لِكَيْ لَا تَأْسَوْ عَلَى مَا فَاتَكُمْ, so that you may not grieve for what escapes you, وَلَا تَفْرَحُوا بِمَا آتَاكُمْ, and not exult for what comes your way. And that is the true characteristic and embodiment of the people who do not never depend on a bounty from the Almighty Allah, and they never lose hope in Allah, specifically during difficulties and hardships. Imam Ali alayhi salam used to say, the whole of Zuhd has appeared in two phrases of the Book of Allah, so that you may not grieve for what escapes you, and not exult for what comes your way. Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about the true meaning of zuhd, that abstinence which is specifically from the worldly pleasures, which has been shown and proved in two phrases, two words, kalimatain, of the Book of Allah. When Allah the Exalted grants His servant with confidence in His destiny and decree, and with reliance on Him, then such a person will constantly be assured of the decree of Allah in ease and hardship both. He would neither be assured of the blessings at his disposal, nor would he despair in times of difficulty. There has been enormous emphasis on this concept in different supplications. A phrase in the ziyarah, famously known as Aminullah, reads, O Allah, let my soul be calm with your decree, pleased with your decision, fond of your remembrance and of calling you, patient in the time of misfortune, and grateful for your abundant bounties. Allahumma faj'al nafsi mutma'innatan biqadarik, radiyatan biqadaik, mula'atan bidhikrika wa du'aik. And of these kinds of prayings are actually abundant in our supplications.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will, God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah, let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God stays with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
In one of his supplications, Imam Ali bin Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Zainul Abidin, says, inspire us to yield to that which you bring upon us by your will, lest we love the delay of what you have hastened and the hastening of what you have delayed. Dislike what you love and choose what you dislike. And in another place, he alayhi salam says, delight my soul through your decree, expand my breast through the instances of your decision, and give to me a trust through which I may admit that your decree runs only to the best. And also in the supplication of Sabah, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, O Allah, here are the reins of my soul. I have tied them to the cords of your will. So this is the true meaning of reliance on the divine planning and tadbir of the Almighty Allah when it comes to beseeching Allah for ourselves. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
The results of ongoing austerity measures in the UK have brought people, ordinary citizens, to their knees. Many in the UK are facing what is known as destitution. Destitution means poverty so extreme that one lacks the means to provide for oneself. The new findings are part of ongoing research by the UK-based NSPCC Scotland and Bernardo's charity organisations. The findings said that poverty remained the core issue being experienced by families in 2019 as it was in 2013. Housing insecurity is a growing problem in some areas and was adversely affecting children experiencing poverty. The report said that families were in dire consequences, experiencing destitution, no food, no secure housing, no heating, and struggling with mental ill health, which means parenting is done under chronic stress. Austerity measures include devastating cuts to vital benefits and services. They are essentially spending cuts that were imposed by the government in the UK since 2009 in the aftermath of the global financial panic of 2007 to 2009, the most crippling economic downturn since the Great Depression, according to the New York Times. In 2011, maximum rents were introduced. Child benefit was frozen for 3 years. Local authority services began to be cut back or completely ended, including youth services, community engagement, and libraries. In 2012, the government led by former Prime Minister David Cameron's Tory-led coalition government, which introduced the so-called British Welfare Reform Act 2012. This act included, among other things, what is known as the controversial bedroom tax, which cut people's housing benefits if they were deemed to have too many bedrooms. It resulted in people being kicked out of their homes for not being able to pay their rent.
We will not be able to build a sustainable recovery with long-term growth unless we fix this fundamental problem of excessive government spending and borrowing that undermines our whole economy.
In 2013, the UK government implemented legal aid cuts, which resulted in a fall in the numbers of people getting state-funded help in benefit cases. By around 2015, food banks could be found in areas that ordinarily would be considered wealthier areas of the UK. These circumstances led to the 2016 Brexit vote, of which the result was to leave the EU in March 2019. Then there were the changes in government. David Cameron resigned as Prime Minister and Theresa May became Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, turning to Brexit, following last week's vote, it is clear that the government's approach had to change. And it has. Having established the confidence of Parliament in this government, I've listened to colleagues across Parliament from different parties and with different views.
In 2017, the Grenfell Tower fire became a symbol of what many in the UK said was poverty and a careless government. In 2018, welfare spending had fallen by almost 25% in the last 10 years, according to figures obtained by MP Frank Field. In 2019, amid Brexit uncertainty, Theresa May resigned and Boris Johnson became Prime Minister.
This has been a disaster, right? Let's not mince our words. I mean, this has been an absolute nightmare for the country. The country's gone through a profound shock. But in those moments, you have the opportunity to change and to do things better. And we really, really want to build back better, to do things differently.
Protests like these, with many getting out of control to become riots, were the scene across London and the UK altogether in the years after 2009. The people despise the measures because it took money out of their pockets. The measures cut their wages and increased their living expenses, such as taxes and utilities, thus making life hard.
People, mainly low-paid workers, have had to pay the price of what the rich and the powerful did to our communities. These people didn't cause the banking crisis. They didn't break our economy, and yet they're paying the price.
And now, as another global recession looms, one that was triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic, and as the supply chains in the UK are affected, London seems to be in trouble.
We're short of skilled construction workers and skilled mechanics and skilled engineers, and we're short of hundreds of thousands of IT experts. And it's not as though the market doesn't require these skills. The market will pay richly.
More children and older people are living in absolute poverty, defined as severe deprivation of basic human needs, including food, safe drinking water, sanitation facilities, health, shelter, education, and information, and inequality rates have spiked. In 2019, the United Nations came out with a scathing report on the effects of austerity measures in the UK. The report by the United Nations Human Rights Council said that food banks have proliferated, homelessness has increased, life expectancy is falling for certain groups, and tens of thousands of poor families are living in accommodations far from schools, jobs, and community networks. The United Nations says that 1.5 million people in the UK experienced destitution in 2017, living on less than £10 a day, about $13 after housing costs.
Present policies continue. It's the people who are living in poverty who are going to be most seriously affected. I think that has a particular resonance in the Brexit context, because the great majority of observers would agree that the Leave side was fueled at least in part by the sense of alienation, the sense of economic insecurity, the sense of not having been cared for by the system.
The UK Department for Work and Pensions totally dismissed these forecasts and reports by the UN, saying it was, quote, barely believable. 2 years later, after that gloomy outlook, though, things still haven't got better in the UK. In fact, one can say that things have taken a turn for the worse.
We're just very worried about the future. We're worried about the second wave of the coronavirus hitting us, especially with Christmas coming. We are not sure whether to commit to stock for Christmas or not, because we don't want to be stuck. But at the same time, if it turns out to be busy, we don't want to miss out on sales.
Dominic adds that people are just not spending.
I think the overall time that people are spending in the shops is less, because people don't really want to be in an enclosed space.
Earlier this year, Britain's economy shrank by one-fifth, or 20.4% in the second fiscal quarter, more than any European neighbour. This comes as the country's decade-old austerity policies, the pending deal or no-trade deal post-Brexit, and now the coronavirus lockdown slammed businesses and plunged the country into its deepest recession on record, according to the Office for National Statistics. This is the UK's first recession since 2009, and the performance is the worst of the so-called group of seven richest countries in the world over the same period. It seems like there's more austerity measures ahead, as London is trying to sell that to its citizens via the coronavirus lockdown. Citizens, however, are catching on, and they say that the underlying problems were there prior to the coronavirus.
Businesses are going to be affected severely. We are not going to see the same situation again as it was before Corona.
Businesses are going to be affected severely. We are not going to see the same situation again as it was before Corona. So unfortunately, people will have to get used to a new reality, and they have to start life from a different perspective. One failed policy followed by another failed government hints at just a part of the underlying problem. It seems that the government, who according to those hurt by austerity, is along with the rich class detached from the people and the circumstances they are in. According to them, until this is fixed, only then can the government understand where the problem lies. Until then, austerity measures backfires to this day.
IRIB English Radio.